Back, I think you meant to say.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay, corrected my typo. Page 36 of the state's brief, footnote 5. State asserts there is no need to confirm in April 2021 whether defendant wished to continue pro se. State stands by that, but it would further note that the trial court did in fact confirm that he wanted to. Pages 15 and 17 of the defendant's reply brief, and in argument today, he said that 401A wasn't administered at the right time. But under Hayes indicates that the most significant consideration is whether the rule was substantially complied with at the time when the defendant was actually considering waiving counsel. And that's what occurred here at the pretrial hearing on August 17. And then I think the trial court followed up on the 24th. On the 17th, he delineated all the charges. They discussed home invasion. But he couldn't recall. He just said the lesser offenses have lesser sentences. And then maybe he caught up with himself. And a week later, he said, I want to go over those with you. So as Justice Vaughn noted, I think once the case law is pretty clear that once the most significant crime and penalties are expressed, then the rest don't really matter. And the trial court did try to talk the defendant out of it. I would note that as well. The defendant on pages 4 and 9 of reply brief contends that because he did file some futile motions, so he lacks sophistication in that sense. But that's kind of a subjective, tricky word on the sophistication. In some of the older cases, the factor is whether he has experience in the criminal justice system, whether he's a criminal experienced defendant, for lack of a better term. And that's why the state put out his criminal history at the beginning of the brief, just to show this is not his first rodeo. The defendant suggests on pages 5 and 7 and 15 of the reply brief, and again in argument today, that the trial court had some duty to explain good sentencing credit or whether the convictions were merged. But it's the state's position, and I don't believe those arguments were raised in the initial brief, but it's the state's position that the trial court was under no obligation to do those things, because the trial court's not even obligated to do those things when a defendant pleads guilty pursuant to 402A. And the state would cite People versus Frizen, 365, Illap 3rd, 932, in support of that. My notes say head notes 4 through 9 and subsequent treatment.
Mr. Marshall, some of the cases that talk about 401 and substantial compliance, it seems to turn on the sophistication of the defendant. And here, as Mr. Whitney points out, this guy is not very sophisticated. He has an unrealistic expectation he's going to hire. He makes a mess of his sentencing hearing. He argues the wrong things and at the wrong times. So how would you comment on his sophistication? It seems to me to be not very sophisticated, which would go against substantial compliance.
Well, I think he didn't do a bad job at the sentencing hearing. He subpoenaed a witness. He made his points. He made a correction to the PSI. It was a minor correction.
So you think he was sophisticated?
I think he was sophisticated. And this is something that passes my mind from time to time, because he did claim for 6 months that he was going to hire Hopkins. And I think the state represented at least once, maybe twice, they had talked to Hopkins. He wasn't interested. And at one point he said, I'm going to hire Paul Christensen, I think. And then they had to advise him that he was no longer alive. So I think there are some themes here that you can detect from the record. And a lot of it, I think, are delays. And that's what gets into the second issue when the trial court denied his request for a continuance. By that time, I think that the trial court, he stated on the record, I believe, this is a delay tactic. He suggested it was before. All these things might have been delay tactics. I don't know the motive behind his motion to suppress that he filed post-trial. I can't imagine he thought that maybe he's crazy like a fox, or he's just thrown in the kitchen sink. But whether someone's sophisticated, like I said, that's tricky.
Do you think 57 days when 60 was requested is unreasonable?
Yeah, I think that the trial court, because he didn't have ready, willing, available counsel at that point, that he didn't have to give him any continuance. He had talked to him about it before. The defendant made these claims about, it takes me at least 60 days to get on the phone. And then when he showed up in April, when the sentencing hearing finally kicked off, I think he indicated, well, I was going to hire a private attorney, but they tampered with my mail and I wasn't able to. So I'm not sure what a trial court is expected to believe as these things proceed on. And these,
at the time, you know, he requested the 60-day continuance, was he housed in the county jail or was he being housed at DOC from a prior sentence?
I don't know, but that's a good point. Because I have encountered cases where I got the sense that they were just trying to delay their transfer to DOC. I don't know if he had been sentenced in White County in June, I believe, but I'm not sure.
The reason
sure
for my question is, I understand in prison, it does take longer to get an attorney on the list on that, but in the county, they'll pretty much give you a call a day if you need one for an attorney.
I think he was in DOC because he specifically mentioned the phone being able to get on. And I think the trial court was like, I can't control those things. But he did give him 60 days.
57.
57, sorry. Yeah. Okay. Page 12 of defendant's reply brief, he suggests that Simpson was a modification of Baper and Johnson. State disagrees. It's set out in the brief. I hope it's not confusing. It probably is. But ultimately, state's position is Cleveland exploited the language. Martin ran with that reasoning. And the ultimate result is Martin's mechanical rule, which its state's position is entirely inconsistent with Hayes's holding that although it is preferable to admonish when a waiver is accepted, failure to do so is not fatal when there's sufficient basis for concluding that the purpose of Rule 401 was not otherwise frustrated.
When do you think the trial judge properly complied with Rule 401? At the Krankel hearing or at the pretrial hearing or the follow-up 7 days later? When was 401 substantially complied with?
I believe, okay, substantially complied with.
Or any compliance?
8/17, August 17, that's when he went through about everything, but he did not have in his memory banks the sentencing range for the lesser offenses. He followed up with those on the 24th. And then on the 22nd, when the defendant showed up, okay, let me stop for a minute. Let's assume that the trial court should have admonished him on February 22nd. He should have admonished him again. He's mechanically required to do so. The defendant had just argued his Krankel hearing. And during his arguments at the Krankel hearing, he complained that he had just been convicted of a home invasion that should have been charged as a domestic battery, and now he's facing 30 to 60 year sentence. The trial court clarified, said, well, actually it's 6 to 30, the extent would be 30 to 60. And then after that is when defendant fired Tyson. So if the trial court would have been required to admonish him fully right then, it would have been, as you just told me, you're facing a 30 to 60 year sentence if it's extended, 6 to 30. You've been convicted of the charges, so you'd have to modify and say you now stand convicted. You're not facing the charges, they're now convictions. So it would seem superfluous, I guess, to just repeat what had just been repeated. When he could sit there and he could look at him and say, I know he knows what he's talking about. He thought it was 30 to 60. Okay, I clarified that. But he had this working knowledge, and there's a theme throughout the record, I think you'll see. He had this working knowledge of the offenses, or at least the main offense, and the sentences he faced, because he was trying to constantly, even in White County at the sentencing hearing, trying to constantly convince whoever would listen, the state's not going to be able to prove the unauthorized entry element. Because I used to live with my grandpa. I used to live with the victim. So I'm running out of time here, but the hypothetical, he would have to admonish him on February 22nd, I think brings full circle to the observation in Davis versus the United States, which is cited in Baker, that a requirement that repeatedly advise an defendant of that which he is already aware makes neither good law nor good sense. And I just ask that you affirm the trial court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Mr. Whitney, you're on mute.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, with respect to Justice Vaughn's question, yes, Mr. Holloway was in IDOC custody at the time. He was temporarily in the jail for the hearing itself, but he asked if he could stay in the jail precisely because that would have made things easier to contact prospective private counsel. And the court refused that request, saying it would be too difficult. He was going back into IDOC. And it was in that context that he then made the request for at least 60 days, which, of course, he did not actually get. I also want to correct opposing counsel on a point. There was no request for continuance. If there had been a request for a continuance, that would at least have a little more similarity to some of the case law on which the state relies, but it wasn't even a request for a continuance. The court had to schedule the post-trial motion and sentencing hearing in any event. It then asked the defendant how much time he needed. The defendant gave the answer, at least 60 days, and the court did not give him at least 60 days. Obviously, there's a difference between at least and about, at least being the bare minimum. And he didn't get the bare minimum that he explicitly requested. With respect to being admonished about the most important part of the sentence, yes, that did occur 6 months prior. But it is very significant in this case, the potential sentences for the other offenses and the extended term sentences that he could have been that could have applied in this case, because whereas it is true that at the pretrial hearing, or excuse me, at the pretrial hearing, at one point, Mr. Holloway did express his understanding that he could get 30 years at 85%. The reality is it could have been a lot more than that. With the extended term sentencing and with the aggravated battery and the criminal damage to property, that could potentially tack on an additional 8 years. So, which he in fact got. So in a case like this, you know, where the defendant at the time he's being admonished said he understood, yeah, he could get 30 years at 85%. It could really be significantly more than that. If the court had given him the wake-up call, hey, it could be, you know, a lot more than that. The state even argued at sentencing that it could, in the alternative, give him 40 years on the home invasion charge, as well as the up to 8 on the other two charges. If he had been given that wake-up call before, it might have changed his decision about deciding to go without assigned counsel. Also, I did want to point out with respect to the incomplete admonitions that were given to him, Rule 401 does say that in going over the penalties with the client, this includes the penalty to which the defendant may be subjected because of prior convictions or consecutive sentences. So it is important to review the extended sentencing range. That's part of the requirements of the rule. And that was not done here in this case. The court expressed it when it did admonish him, the court expressed uncertainty about that. It expressed uncertainty about whether it would be 50% or 85%. And as a matter of fact, it actually misinformed him by telling Mr. Holloway that that would be up to the discretion of IDOC, when in fact the 85% was mandated by statute. So there were some flaws in the Rule 401 admonitions that Mr. Holloway received 6 months before it actually mattered. So when you look at the totality of this, the incomplete admonitions that were given 6 months prior to when it actually mattered, the lack of sophistication, the evident lack of sophistication that cries out from the entirety of this record of this particular defendant, and the fact that the court did not honor his reasonable request for a post-trial period of time to hire private counsel when he was already incarcerated and already convicted, this was unreasonable. There was an abuse of discretion on that issue. And reviewing de novo, there was not compliance with Rule 401. Accordingly, we respectfully request the court to vacate the denial of his post-trial motion and remand for new post-trial and sentencing proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitney. Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Justice Welch, any questions?
No question.
Justice Vaughn?
Sorry, no questions.
Okay.
Got a weed eater going on outside my